Hey, welcome to the year-end wrap-up of the FinTech Newscast, where we will be talking about the biggest significant stories of the past year and what they might mean for 2021. With me, as always, is Steve.
John, happy end of the year.
Happy end of the year to you. Glad you made it. We're lucky to have Sean joining us this episode. He hasn't been with us for a little while, so welcome back.
Thanks, John. Happy to be back.
Yeah, glad you can join. So I'm going to start off. It was a crazy year, obviously. You
So
didn't
much
have to
happened.
download a podcast to be told that. But there were a lot of changes in fintech as well. Some of the things, I think a lot of things that it kind of are ramping up during the pandemic will just keep driving forward into 2021 and beyond. At least that's the way I see it. I see these trends just going forward.
It's what didn't change this year, right, John? I mean, there's the whole world changed, but also the fintech landscape changed. We're not going into banks as much, and fintechs seem to be doing really well in terms of the capital they've been able to bring in. Some of the strong players have led the way, like Plaid and Stripe. But we'd love to hear like what your thoughts are on what are the biggest changes in 2020.
Yeah, I was really surprised that the venture funding had stayed so strong. I thought they would really collapse, just like a lot of things, like the stock market, has taken off. Bitcoin prices have taken off, and there's that disconnect between the fundamental economy, unemployment rates, and everything, and compared to what the markets have done, and that's benefited fintechs. I know we've mentioned before how Chime and Robinhood and the buy now pay later valuations have stayed strong. A lot, some of the fintechs as well, or wealth techs as well. So it's always hard to say for sure, what's going to happen, because there's this kind of crazy disconnect.
There's almost like it's like the Wild West, but even more wild.
But even more wild than a shootout at the OK Corral?
Yeah.
Almost that
Throw
wild.
on your favorite Western.
Well, there
Yeah.
have been some casualties, and so I'm going to jump into Robinhood. That's been a big story. They've managed to suck up the media attention for fintechs for a while there. Apparently, they went to the Donald Trump school of sucking the air out of all the news,
Out of everything.
out of everything. But they've had a lot of good things, of course. Their volumes have been going crazy, and their valuations have been going crazy as well. You know, they've had five funding rounds just in 2020.
Oh my God, that's insane. I had no, I
Whoa.
did not track of that. That's an amazing stat, John.
Well, yeah, some were like extensions of like a previous round, so they had a second F round kind of thing. But yeah, five times they've gone out to get money. But there's been some negatives along with that too. I mean, we keep seeing, actually, even now through December of 2020, they keep having outages and problems. They're the second most company to have outages of out of all of the brokerages. I think it was Vanguard, which is number one, which is like the largest one and much bigger than Robinhood. But
Yeah,
so they're
that
not
makes
the
sense.
worst one, but maybe per customer they are.
Yeah, and just for context here, it's funny that you mentioned all the funding rounds that they've gone through. They were valued at $11 billion as of August of this year, and they're looking to go public with an IPO with Goldman Sachs next year, early next year, at a $20 billion valuation. So imagine gaining $9 billion in market cap in just what, 4, 5, 6 months? It's incredible.
They're
Wow,
rounding
yeah.
up a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
So they had a big outage in, was it March or February, March? That was like the one of the big
Just
first
name a
big
month.
outages that
Yes.
and they've just been consistently seeing outages. Have you, I mean, they must be making long term because sort of like changes in their system and their platform to prevent this kind of thing from happening. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I think it's just they just keep scaling up, and it keeps getting ahead of them, apparently. I'm looking at the last news from December 7th, where they're talking about restoring service on a wide trading outage. I think they just they're probably scaling up, and then the volumes keep going up beyond what they can handle.
Yeah, it's the difficulties of scaling, right? And they're also, I think they're maybe live in the UK, but they're only in the US right now, because that's where they have all the licenses. So yeah, imagine when they eventually go global, with which at this pace could happen. But The second story that I think is worth noting here, or the second trend rather that I noticed for 2020 is the fact that there's a lot of investment and a lot of focus nowadays on consumer permission data. And what do I mean by that? Essentially, we saw when Visa acquired Plaid this year, although there's some pushback now from DOJ to actually maybe stop that merger from taking place. And then we also saw a Visa competitor, MasterCard, going after Finicity. So the idea is enabling customers to grant access to their financial data seems to be one of the biggest trends of 2020, which when taken into account also with what happened in the UK with the open banking stuff as well, it seems like there's kind of a new dawn of customer-driven financial data that will shape the whole financial landscape in the next 2 to 3 years. That's my prediction.
Right. Just in the next few months, there's going to be a Biden administration coming in, and they have very different priorities than the previous administration. They're focused on financial inclusion, getting access to credit for lower income people, younger people. But they're also going to be a lot tougher in a lot of ways. They're going to crack down on the use of AI to make credit decisions, to make sure that there's not discrimination. They're going to crack down on things like climate change disclosures. So a lot of pluses and minuses. But I think fintechs that are working on lower income, on financial inclusion, on credit availability, might find some friendly regulatory response if they're in alignment with the administration goals.
That's a good point. I think that next year we'll see more talk about fintech and financial health as well. And it's something that I think we saw a lot of it in 2020, but with having an administration that is like is more friendly to those kind of products and ideas, we'll see a lot more interest and investments in that space as well.
Yeah, well, so we'll definitely see a change in regulatory landscape. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you mentioned, John, I think this new administration is going to bring some unknowns, but from what I've gathered, the administration is, will generally be friendly to, big tech players, to Wall Street. It doesn't seem like there's going to be any like immediate antitrust laws or rollouts that are going to scare Wall Street or Silicon Valley. Curious to know in terms of like user privacy data that you mentioned, Steve, do you think we're going to be seeing like more regulations protecting the user or the big man? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it'll likely go towards the consumer side and strengthening consumer data protection. We saw that in California, where we all live, Prop 24 passed as well. And I think that, like in many other things regarding regulation, California is something that really sets the tone for the national agenda. And we may see stronger consumer privacy efforts roll out from the state, maybe to the other states, and potentially under Biden to a more federal framework, giving control back to consumers and taking it away from the companies that trade in your data and my data.
Yeah, we can already see that happening
Well,
with the Facebook lawsuit from the FTC. They want to take that apart. They want to reduce some of that power. And that's already happening today.
yeah, I think I would agree with both of you that the trend is up until now has been that the big man, the Silicon Valley tech companies have really had all the leverage in this trade-off, really just jumbled terms of services, terms of use, agreements that you have to check off and agree to before you sign up. But it seems like within the cultural trend with movies like The Social Dilemma, a lot of these more public cases, as you mentioned, John, being open for us to see, are probably caused the tides to shift towards a bit more towards the user and protecting the user's privacy. See, so I hope, Steve, you're right that these new trends are going to be more tailored towards the users.
My other big story of the year is, of course, Wirecard, which we've talked about. It feels like ad infinitum here on the podcast, but basically, for those of us who don't know the story, there was a German payments company called Wirecard, and essentially, it all ended up with the founder being arrested for potentially embezzling $1.2 billion. So, in addition to all the feel-good stories about how fintech is taking over the world, how fintech is really going to help with, things like financial health, how fintech helped with PPP as well, we're also seeing the darker side of fintech now. I think this will not be the last of these things we see. We may see more of these. We saw it with a company called Beam also, which we discussed last week as well. But I think that we may see more massive flameouts as more interest is coming into our industry.
Yeah, when there's this like I was mentioning, that when there's this much money coming in and funding so many small companies, I was looking at all the different wealth tech companies that were getting funded recently, and all the niches that they were getting into, all the markets, and how they can't possibly survive. Of course, some of the people, like as in Wirecard, turn to less than legal ways to move forward or to escape with some cash.
Yeah,
Just
that's a
below
very
legal.
politically correct way to say it, John. Just below legal.
Just a bit
What is
shy.
Wirecard? So they're just a payment processor?
Yeah, they're basically a payments processor. They work with a lot of the big payments players, mostly in the EU.
Who is in charge of coming up with these guys' name? I mean, really, like Wirecard, could they have come up with maybe something a bit more creative?
It's actually kind of a cool name. It describes what they do. They're
It's very
a company
catchy.
providing cards. It's super catchy. Yeah, Wirecard. Wirecard, if
Right,
you're German.
we could agree to disagree on that one, Steve, but
Well,
I feel like all the fintech names out there, we can get creative. It's got to have fewer letters, fewer syllables, and then be like the name of a exotic cat or something. That's more Silicon Valley, I think.
that brings me to the largest fintech in the world I wanted to bring up, Ant. Is that simple enough, clear-cut enough for you?
That is perfect. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
It's also,
Yeah.
speaking of logos, Ant has the, or rather, speaking of names, Ant has the ugliest logo in the fintech world. It's just a crappily drawn ant.
Yeah. It looks like your Series A financing kind of fintech logo.
Not a massive Chinese-backed company. But yeah, what's the story with Ant, John? They had kind of a tumultuous year.
They were about to go public when Jack Ma just said a little bit too much and got into the crosshairs of Xi Jinping. And actually, they dropped financial. So I think it's like Ant Group now or just Ant. But they're massive. I mean, they really are the largest fintech in the world by a lot. They have 500 million people that have borrowed money from them. And that's out of a total population in China of 1.4 billion. 70% of people in China use their app, and they've made over 20 million business loans as well. And so they were about to go public in China with about a $300 billion valuation. But you're working in a communist dictatorship country. And what's the most important thing when you're operating in a communist dictatorship?
Toe the party line.
Kind of.
Don't tick
Don't
off the government, right?
tick off the dictator. If you're in a communist dictatorship, make sure that dictator is really happy with you. And that's where Ant, or I should say Jack Ma, got Ant into trouble, where he was complaining about how the regulators in China were holding them back, how they didn't know what they were doing, basically. And this got back to good old Xi Dada, daddy of communist China, Xi Jinping. And he reportedly, according to the Wall Street Journal, got very angry. And a lot of his top lieutenants said, yes, sir, you're right to be angry. And they put a quick stop to the IPO. So the
Talk
world's
about
largest fintech is still not gone public. They were at $150 billion just about a year and a half ago. And they were going to be $300 billion through the IPO, but that's a bit on hold right now.
Wow. So, any idea what he said that ticked off Chinese officials?
Yeah, so Jack Ma, he made a speech on October 24th, which seems to have been the one that set this off, although he said other things. So he made a 21-minute speech where he criticized Beijing's campaign to control financial risks. He said there is no systemic risk in China's financial system. Chinese finance has no system. So regulators were, and he directly criticized the regulators. He says they've only focused on risk and overlooked development, and that they had a lot of Chinese banks were basically behind, and they had like a pawn shop mentality that's hurt a lot of entrepreneurs. So he was bashing a little bit more than probably you should. So these went viral in China's social media. That made Xi Jinping very upset. He only likes to hear very, very positive things, and he wants everyone to toe the party line. Actually, they stole my motto from college, where they say basically, we have no choice but to follow the party.
Wow.
There you go.
He made this speech and basically Did the Chinese government overtly say it was because of the speech, or was it just this magical IPO not happening sort of deal?
That's the funny part. Much like these new regulations that have blocked Australian exports into China that suddenly appeared when China was mad at Australia. And it's the same, they have the same MO for all of their activities. They say it's a regulation or something that are not getting done, but these things only get enforced when there's some political purpose behind it. And that's what's happened here. They came out with these new rules that IPOs would have to follow in China, but these are suddenly becoming enforced all of us just right after this speech happened. So it's kind of like they have rules, and if you're in with the king, you're fine. You don't have to really abide that closely. But if you're on the outs, they're going to make every reason under the sun to stop what you're doing.
They're going to bring the hammer down on you. Yeah, yeah. Makes
hammer
sense.
On the ant.
Hammer on the ant, yes. Did they plan to go public in the US or in newly part of China? Hong
no,
Kong?
No, no. This would have been in Shanghai.
In Shanghai. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Part of their efforts to move their finances more domestically.
Speaking of domestic, I'd love to hear your take on this, Sean. We've had a crazy year for Bitcoin, and you're sort of a resident Bitcoin guy and also our institutional crypto guy. What is your take on what happened in 2020 and what we can see in 2021?
Yeah, it's been a monster year for the crypto space, really led by Bitcoin. I mean, this bull run is something that we haven't seen since 2017. If you remember, a few years ago, right around this time, Thanksgiving, Christmas, people were starting to talk more about crypto around the Thanksgiving table. And then that kind of carried momentum through the end of 2017. This bull run it's similar in terms of numbers, but really not the same in terms of what we think the causes are for this sort of bull run. This bull run seems to be more driven by institutional investors. Are you talking about big names in the banking industry coming around, really investing in this space? We've also seen an additional, jolt from companies like PayPal, who are now starting to see this the power of cryptocurrency. PayPal announced they're going to be launching crypto payment services in early 2021. And JP Morgan came out and said they're bullish on Bitcoin now, saying that the asset has a potential long-term upside. And so this bull run's a bit different because of this institutional push is what's causing it. This trend that we're seeing with institutional capital coming in, I think is going to carry into 2021. I don't think there's going to be much of a pullback. At least the signs are there. But then again, we don't know. This is a volatile asset. I mean, this is more volatile than Tesla. And every investor should know that this is a very volatile asset class. One of those things that we're seeing in the space is that retail is not leading this charge as much as it is institutional. So, Steve, to answer your question, really, the institutional money is what's been pushing this bull run. And I think we'll see some strength into 2021 as interest rates remain low and people are seeking alpha.
What about Bitcoin for regular Joe Schmoes like you and I?
I think the argument for it being a store of value, a digital store of value, similar to gold, is something that I've heard a lot. And I think it's interesting because that narrative seems to be catching steam. I think retail money is going to continue to pour in. The 2017 bull run was definitely retail focused. I mean, these are like your, family members, your cousins. I remember I bought my first Bitcoin around that time and just seeing the power of that of the space. And then you kind of compare it to now, which is it is led by institutional money. I do think most people now on Main Street know about the crypto revolution, but there's still a lot of work to do.
So I know Coinbase and Gemini have been developing their institutional support to drive this trend. Actually, I haven't heard too much about Gemini lately. Have you?
Gemini's also been one of the leading exchanges along with the others that are really trying to build out their institutional practice, because there are so many people that are institutional investors, like Paul Tudor Jones, for example, who is a icon in the institutional finance space, who has come out and said, you got to pick the fastest bull. And that fastest bull is Bitcoin. It's in the crypto space. I think the exchanges are starting to see the value of this institutional money coming in, and they're racing to build institutional support to custody those assets.
I just want to see the Winklevoss twins' market value surpass Mark Zuckerberg's.
You think they're still after revenge so many years later? They just want to surpass Mark Zuckerberg?
I just want to see it myself. It would be pretty funny, actually. Yes, but they've been working on that institutional support for a long time, offering things like cold storage, analytical support, all the things that large investment funds are supposed to have when they're investing your money like that. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see it. I mean, it's been under development for a while. And I think one of our guests reminded me that these things just take time. It's not going to just appear. So as much as I've been so excited to see these developments, they're still happening and they just take longer than you think they do. But maybe like you're saying, we'll see that turning point more and more in 2021.
Yeah. I think so. I think we'll see some of the maturation of the asset class continue in 2021. I also think that 2021 will be the year of DeFi, so decentralized finance. These projects are seeing so much money come into their balance sheets from institutional investors and retail investors who want a slice of the action. This is DeFi, which is counter to CeFi, centralized finance. These are decentralized financial applications that are seeing so much of the second and third order effects of all of this action happening in the space. People are putting money into crypto. They're looking for assets to invest in because they see the upside of the leader of Bitcoin, which has led this bull run. And now we're starting to see these other projects gain more attention, both from retail investors and institutional investors. And this has just been augmented by companies like Square putting more crypto on their balance sheet. And across the board, from large banking institutions down to smaller to medium-sized and smaller fintechs, we're starting to see this gravity towards an adoption of the asset class as a legitimate asset class. It's come a long way, and I think we'll see that momentum continue into next year.
So Sean, you mentioned both decentralized finance and also centralized finance, right? DeFi and CeFi. I think my other big thing that I saw this year, my other trend for 2020 would be NFI, embedded finance. We saw this, the rise of this space, right? With companies like Affirm, which I think will go public either this year or early next year, Klarna, Afterpay, there's a few players. So basically the whole model is that you can be a company that sells, I don't know, coffee mugs online. And through one of these services, you can embed a financial service product on your website so that you can say have a buy now, pay later function or even an underwriting function on your site without you becoming a financial service provider. So we've seen this take hold. We discussed, I think, 2 weeks ago, the Affirm IPO and their relationship to Peloton as well. But it seems like everyone now has an embedded finance product, even if they're not a financial services company.
What's an example of like an embedded finance product that I maybe use daily or weekly? I'm not super familiar with that.
You log on to the Peloton website, you want to buy one, and you see, oh my God, this thing costs $3,000. That's way too expensive. And then you see a button say, pay in installments with Klarna, or in this case, likely Affirm, right? And the idea is that you go through that company, Peloton will give Affirm some amount of revenue share. Affirm would basically underwrite you and you pay Affirm directly where then Peloton ships you the bike so that you're not actually putting stuff on your credit card. Peloton doesn't have a whole finance department like you see with auto dealerships. It's just a storefront. And then you have that third party, either Klarna or Affirm, kind of take on all the financial responsibilities to make sure they can sell more product.
So it's just a way to defer payment. It's kind of like a payment plan embedded in the actual product when I'm checking out.
That's the most common use case. Yeah, it's just a payment plan on a non-financial product. You can also see it with Amazon, where Amazon provides some working capital for some of their people who some of their marketplace partners as well. So I think the whole idea of providing services where they're needed and going to where the customer is to provide FS is sort of gets to the point of embedded finance as a big story in 2020, but one that I think will be much bigger in 2021.
That brings up the question of sort of retail spending. And I know we've talked about this in the past. Any thoughts on like where retail spending is headed, like, consumer credit spending and, people are now sitting at home, they're buying more Pelotons, they're buying all these non-financial products for their homes. Do you think that retail spending is, any thoughts on like, if you think it's going to increase and or decrease? And I think that answer would also help understand if these people are going to use these embedded financial products as well.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a push and pull. I think that at least from my experience and what I see with my circle of friends is that everyone's spending money or either improving their home or experiences. Like no one's buying stuff anymore. I haven't bought a pair of shoes in I think a year or so.
Wow, that's a lot. You used to have best shoes. I remember that.
So many, right? So I think that there's kind of two different things at play here. One is the rise in, as I mentioned, embedded finance and Klarna and Affirm. But I think that those things tend to fund stuff that you buy. But I see that even as we come out of this COVID winter, right? People will want to do more experiences, but want to either, again, improve their nest at home or just finally go on vacation. And I think you may see a drop or a continued drop as well, or maybe just a slow recovery in the retail space.
I was really surprised. You know, we talked about that discrepancy between the markets and the economy, but that credit card balances have gone down during the pandemic.
It makes sense. I mean, you're not spending as much money on crap anymore. Like I don't spend money on anything other than, I don't know, occasionally a coffee or something, but it's not Amazon. Exactly. Amazon. Thank you.
John, to your point about credit card balances really being lower as a general trend recently, do you think those are going to jump back up after the floodgates open? We go back to normal or people, do you think people are going to go back to that high, really high level of credit card spending that we saw kind of towards the end of 2019?
Well, I think things are going to continue to get worse for us. We saw unemployment numbers kind of bounce up after recovering for a while. It's been ages since the stimulus money ran out. I think that fed a lot of people were paying down debt, but now are having to reborrow and it'll just kind of get worse. So I don't see and I think it'll take longer to recover. I don't see a sharp, just quick bounce back to where we were before, in the economy. I think this will take at least through 2021 into 2022, and we'll just have to see from there. Every situation is different, but normally you don't see just things reappear as they were before. They evolve and they change, and that takes some time.
It'll be interesting to see if these spending habits that we're sort of forced to have right now, like with regard to our daily lives and putting less money on credit cards, if those are going to stick or we're just going to go back to how we were in 2019. But either way, I think it'll be exciting to see.
Maybe we'll be the grandparents, you know, the grandkids talk about. They go, oh, you know, they're so careful with their money. You know, they lived through the pandemic.
Right.
We'll be the new depression generation.
They wash their hands so thoroughly, these guys.
Yeah, they're nuts with that. Right. They're very uptight. So one thing that has been coming back strongly are new bank charters. It seems like the first time earlier this year, I was like, oh, this is a big deal. Like Varo is getting a bank charter. You never see that. And just to give you some point of comparison, in the first half of 2020, only two new commercial banks started filing quarterly reports with the FDIC. So they had their bank charter and had to start filing. So two of them in the first half of this year. Guess how many there were in 2007?
Oh my God, great question. Zero? One?
2007, so at the crux of the financial crisis. So in 2007, there were 164 new commercial banks filing with the FDIC.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So just to give you an idea of the scale of how things have been so slow and how new banks just have not been appearing since the financial crisis. So this is a little bit of a recovery we've been seeing these days with these new bank charters and why it's such a shock to see these. We're just getting past the point where we stop saying, oh, this is the first challenger bank to get a bank charter. Oh, this is the first payments company to get a bank charter. Now we're seeing the second, third ones, and they're starting to roll in. So if history is any guide, there was a lot of activity prior to the financial crisis because people wanted to pile in and make money. But even if we get to half of that 164 amount, that will still be a recovery of where we were before. And this is a bit of bad news, I think, for the incumbent large banks. because now we'll start to see these well-funded, increasingly large fintech companies with no hindrance. They'll have their, they'll be getting their bank charters. And I think this is going to really scale up into 2021, where they can be stronger competitors and full banks. They won't need to partner or use banking as a service or wealth tech as a service or anything like that. They'll be the platform.
So this is kind of in line, John, with the whole concept of every company is becoming a bank, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of interest. And, it saves a lot of cost. There's some things you can't do. You're prohibited regulatory-wise from doing as a, when you partner with a bank. They get you some of the way there, but not all the way. So there's a lot of advantages to having your own charter, especially as you get larger. Hmm.
Did you get a charter, John? Are you going to become a bank too?
I'm going to apply. Early next year, I'm going to submit my charter. I'm going to do an ILC, the industrial, the easiest loan charter. So yeah, it's not that big a deal.
And then that comes with the John card?
Right. It's funny how you can put all these services together with these APIs and these services. But more likely, I will sell that that banking platform to enable other companies and just make money by selling picks and shovels, much like Cross River Bank does. They're doing pretty well.
Do they just white label their basically their name and work with sort of a Cross River model? Is that like kind of a bank in a box model where they'll white label? Okay, that's happening. It sounds like the bank in a box model is sort of part of leading, or at least part of that trend.
Yeah, you just you're just doing the marketing, and you're leaving all the regulatory compliance and operations to somebody else. You pay them for the service, and they're happy to do it.
And that allows them to basically do this at scale. Companies can do this at scale because they're saving so much on the cost. They're outsourcing a lot of that cost, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is more expensive to do it that way rather than having your own charter. So once you get to a certain size, and like we're seeing with these larger fintechs, they want to get their own bank charters, and there are limitations as well. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. I'm going to guess a lot more than the two that we saw in the first half of this year. All right, Steve. You are always looking in the future. So tell us, what are your predictions for 2021?
Oh, I have one that's
Futuristic
not fintech. Future Steve. My prediction is that as of today, we saw that the DoorDash IPO, their IPO, their price, their stock price went up 80-something% in one day. It had a huge pop.
Wow.
I think that after the pandemic and everyone stops getting food delivery and kind of rejoins the world of dining out and going out to restaurants, I think we'll see a drastic drop in DoorDash prices.
Yeah, the market
so
seems
wait to buy the stock.
Yeah, short the stock if you can.
Yeah, the market seems very, very hot for the economic side of things, doesn't it? I mean, these valuations are crazy.
They're crazy. And, you know, I think on the flip side, I would say if you can buy into the Airbnb IPO, because that's an entirely different model. I think DoorDash has succeeded because of the pandemic. Airbnb has succeeded despite the pandemic.
And Zoom, the same kind of story then? Once the
Zoom,
pandemic's
I think it's
done?
The same kind of story. I was going to meet a friend of mine for like a walk along the beach. And she's like, you know, I'm kind of concerned about COVID, whatever. I'm being really cautious. Like, I'm just like, that's fine. And then she suggested let's meet on Zoom. And I was like, no way. I'll just see you next year. I do not want to join a single Zoom call ever again. I'm so sick of it. I don't see Zoom maintaining their awesome price into 2021. In fact, we saw how their shares dropped something like 17% when Pfizer announced news of the vaccine. So yeah, Zoom is not going to be this massively valued company at the end of 2021.
Hopefully, because this pandemic will be over, right? So yeah, we have the vaccines coming in. That's going to take some time to produce, and that's going to change the world again, I guess.
Yeah, indeed.
That's all I'll say about the future.
Yeah.
We'll keep changing.
How about you, Sean?
I think next year is going to be the year of full Wall Street, Main Street adoption of cryptocurrencies, and not just Bitcoin, but I think we're going to see some of the the medium and smaller size projects get the kind of attention that they've never received from bigger players. And I do think there's going to be a race, as you mentioned earlier, John, to institutionalize this space. There really needs to be a strong infrastructure on the custody side for a creation of like a stable system for us to trade on these platforms. I think we're still seeing a lot of platforms similar to the Geminis of the world that are just really seeing a ton of influx. You know, they're seeing all these users come in, and they're not necessarily able to handle all that influx. So they're building that infrastructure. I think next year is the year of institutionalization of crypto. And I think we're going to see more companies do what PayPal did and what Square did and what JP Morgan's doing. I think the trends and the momentum is only going in that direction. But I still think there will be volatility because, you know, there's a small group of people that own a lot of it. And if they sell, then you may see some more volatility. But I do think we're going to see a fun year ahead for the crypto space.
A fun year ahead. It could mean a lot of things. The price is shooting up and down, and the market's collapsing or taking off. So yeah, no, I think it's going to be a little bit crazy. All right, yeah, we'll definitely follow up with you too next year and see if your predictions have come true. I know the listeners are hanging on your every word and are going to make all their investment decisions based on what you guys are saying.
Definitely don't do that.
Oh, for sure. Do not listen to me, please. No one ever does.
All right. Well, that wraps up the FinTech Newscast for 2020, and we're happy to wrap it, especially this year, up a little bit earlier than usual. But we'll be back in January to keep you up on the latest in FinTech news. And thanks for listening.